Mr. Chairman, just for it to be clear, it's so you don't have to go and get a resolution of the House each time. You simply do it by a subpoena, which is already set up in there. And I don't have a problem, well, let me leave it at that. It was.
Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 496, Judiciary, with individual recommendations. The 31286 version.
This is the act relating to divorce, dissolution, annulment, amending Rule 84A, last rule of civil procedure. Members, I think, have had individual briefings from Representative Fox or Representative Grunberg on this. The motion is before us to accept the 31286 version of CS for House Bill 496 Judiciary. Is there objection to that motion?
That's for discussion.
He's moving it out. However, if you want to have some discussion, if Mr. Clarkson wants to highlight the changes for the record, that would be fine.
Yeah, I'll object for purpose.
Okay, yeah, it's a good idea to put it on the record. So we'll do that.
Mr. Chairman, there are essentially four changes, although they appear several places throughout the bill. First, at the suggestion of the court system, the new references to tax consequences have been deleted wherever they appear in the bill. You recall that the bill was attempting to rewrite it to require that people consider the tax consequences of their dissolution, and upon reflection and at the recommendation of the court system, that concept is being eliminated in the existing language of the law. Being restored. The second change is the deletion of subparagraph 5 on heightened level of scrutiny. Obviously can't point you to it because it's been deleted, but if you look at an earlier draft of the bill, it is the language that caused some concern because it was so vague. The language was heightened level of scrutiny if one party has not worked for wages for at least 3 years or had a limited future earning capacity. That has been eliminated because of its vagueness and the difficulty of applying it. Thirdly, a technical change has been made, the addition of Section 10 to implement the name change concept that was discussed by Representatives Pettyjohn and Grunberg. As I reviewed the existing law, I realized there was another section that we had to change in order to do that. So we've done it in Section 10, again, to implement the other sections on name change. And finally, on the last page of the committee, substitute a new definition of career assets that incorporates the concern that the consideration of those career assets be limited to those assets that were acquired as a result of the contributions made by the other spouse, so that we didn't have the multiple spouse situation.
What page is that?
Last page of the document.
The record will show that Representative Phillips is present. Welcome back.
There's also a letter of intent.
Well, well rested, sir.
Talk about it at the appropriate time.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the bill? Randy, we're discussing 496, which individuals have had briefings from the subcommittee. Is there objection still maintained to passing out the bill?
Yeah.
The definition on page 10, career assets, what's meant by were acquired at least in part as a direct or indirect contribution made by the other spouse?
Mr. Chairman, a direct contribution, an example of a direct contribution would be cash payment. An example of an indirect contribution would be the maintenance of the home and family while a person is going to school.
What does the words at least in part mean?
Well, if there are two spouses, the guy works part-time and goes to school in the evenings, he's contributed his share to that, and all that's required is that the other spouse contribute a part, at least in part. It's a shared arrangement. The concept of a marriage, of course, is that it's a shared arrangement and both are contributing to the development of the assets of the marriage.
I guess my confusion is that we have the typical position again, situation. He has, he's now 45, was divorced 6 years before. He's had a very stable practice. he marries, and 3 years go by, and at the end of the 3 years, now we're having a divorce.
A dissolution.
A dissolution.
The answer, if I can interrupt, the answer to the question is, I think, that these are dissolutions and the two parties have to agree.
Right, but it's also going to be language utilized in divorce law.
Dissolution section is.
So now we're making dissolutions again different from divorce law?
What's that?
Why in the world are we doing that to people? I thought we were trying to clean that up.
It's a lot easier where the two parties have to agree, and that's the concept of the dissolution.
Yeah, I understand that. Basically, with a dissolution, you don't even have to tell them that. They have to agree to anything they're going to do anyhow.
Right. Yeah.
But this type of definition can only be applied in dissolutions.
Yes. Section 290, which is where this definition appears, is the dissolution section.
I understand that, but my fear, Mr. Chairman, is that such language will be taken as legislative intent by the courts and then bootstrapping off of that. On any contested divorce where the question of career assets comes up, they will look for a definition and certainly be given one here.
Well, of course, that'd be fine with me because I think it's a fair concept. And some of your hesitation, I think, is with the difficulty of calculation. And that's precisely, if this were to be applied to a disputed relationship, disputed divorce, that's what the judicial process is for, to establish a division of property based on equitable standards and the contribution of each of the two spouses.
That's always been very simple when you're dealing with tangible assets. And our law has always been based upon how was it acquired, was it prior to the marriage, through inheritance, or sweat of the brow in essence. And equitable principles were applied to that, and you could get somebody to appraise it and tell you. Take my same example and assume that the doctor's stable practice went downhill for the 3 years he was married. Is she now liable to him because she played a part in it going downhill?
Self-obligation.
Obligation's in there, of course.
Well, let's assume he's been able to pay his bills and he doesn't owe any more debts than when he started. It's just he's not making as much off his practice 3 years later.
Not as much to divide the time.
Yeah.
But that's the effect. He's not making as much money. Did you have a specific thing, or did you just do not be?
No, I wanted to suggest a possible amendment to line 7 on page 10. It had a new sentence which would read, a division of career assets shall take into consideration the extent to which each spouse has contributed to the acquisition of the career asset. And the point of the amendment is that I want the magistrate or whoever is dealing with this question to look at this career asset and analyze it in terms of who really helped acquire it. Now, if you've got a doctor whose wife put him through medical school, and as soon as he gets out and makes some bucks, he ditches her, well, she's got a pretty substantial contribution that she made. On the other hand, if you've got a person who's acquired his career asset largely on his own, and but at some point marries, and the wife will argue, well, hey, I helped out too, you know. I mean, after your practice went from you were used to net $80,000 a year when I married you, now you're making $100,000, and I contributed to that asset by taking care of the kids or whatever. Well, I think in the second case, she's made less of a contribution. In the first case, she's made a lot more. I'd just like that to be on the table to be considered.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I oppose the amendment for a couple of reasons. First of all, the concept that you expressed at the last meeting was that they need to be tied together. That is, that a person not have a right to a career asset if they didn't contribute to it. This amendment, this new language was written to take care of that problem. The second problem you're raising is whether or not there's going to be an equitable distribution, that's required in the body of the dissolution statute, which requires the determination that the distribution is fair, just, and equitable.
Well, I just think that it's worth our while to put this language in to guide the court on what we as a legislature consider to be fair, just, and equitable. I just want to make it clear to the court that just because a spouse has made some, perhaps minimal, contribution, that this isn't all of a sudden half her, depends on how much you contribute.
For the benefit of Mr. Rimford, who's here, would you repeat your proposed amendment?
Max, I'm on page 10 of the committee substitute, on line 7, and I propose the addition of the following language: a division of career assets shall take into consideration the extent to which each spouse has contributed to the acquisition of a career asset.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just, it seems to me the same language that we're trying to get on line 6 already as a result of direct or indirect contribution.
I don't think so. I think that if your spouse,
about volume, not
the extent. I mean, if you can show, you can make a case and say, hey, look, I made a contribution. Wasn't much, but I made a contribution, and you know, this is, you know, I want half, and you know, if she deserves half, fine.
You're not talking about a contested proceeding.
I understand, but we're talking about a heightened scrutiny proceeding.
You're talking about a proceeding where the standard of fair, just, and equitable already applies.
I understand. I just want to give that magistrate a little guidance. I move the amendment.
I better withdraw my motion and move the bill if we want to get this all right.
I'll do. You know, if there's going to be more amendments, and that's perfectly proper, I'm not going to try to describe it. If there's more amendments, I think we ought to move it. But if we can settle this now without a lot of time, then I'd like to get the bill out of the way. We're making a career out of it. That's a career asset for us.
I'm sorry, I was a few minutes late. This seems to me an innocuous amendment, and it's pretty much what the court does now. What is the problem?
As many as are in favor of the amendment, they raise their hands. Mr. Phillips, Mr. Pettijohn, Mr. Fedon, Mr. Lindbergh, any opposed? Mr. Fox, Mr. Miller. Are you going to do that?
I'll vote in court. Mr. Chairman, I'll move CS for House Bill 496 Judiciary as amended by Judiciary Committee to 312-86 version, individual recommendation.
Are you raising your hand in objection, Mr.
Chairman? Yeah. I've been looking through the CS here trying to find this thing. I'm found here.
Do you check the bill or a certain section?
No, I was looking for that very thing.
Unusual custody arrangements? That is unchanged.
Six.
It appears on page 8, line 3, 4.
I thought I was told the heightened level of scrutiny had been removed.
No. The one segment that
we took out was the one provision.
The one provision that was taken out.
The provision.
Provision that Max couldn't explain to us. The one wage earner.
That's the only thing you took out of here, was the one wage earner? So if either party goes to an attorney, that automatically does it?
Yeah.
They got to go heightened level of scrutiny.
If one, if only one. If they both?
Well, I said if either one.
And the other is not.
Right. That just means you can't even turn and go in. That way you avoid heightened scrutiny. Nobody's attorney files an appearance.
Right.
Or unusually high or low child support, and we don't have any definition in here for what unusually high or low child support is.
I don't want to discourage discussion on the bill. Why don't we just put aside and make an opinion meeting? But I, we've got a whole lot of people waiting on the other side.
Yeah, we've got a motion. I call a question on the motion.
No, we've had this for a long time. I know, we've got an often.
Okay, I'm objecting, and I'm moving to amend by deleting page seven, section 12 in its entirety.
Section 7, that's the heightened scrutiny section?
Yep.
Okay, Mr. Taylor moves to amend the bill by deleting section 12 in its entirety, beginning on line 23, page 7.
Question.
Okay, as many as in favor of the motion, raise your hand. Mr. Taylor, Mr. Pettigrew, Mr. Phillips, and Mr. Cole, raise your hand. Clark, Mr. Greenberg, and Mr. Moore. Are there further amendments to be proposed?
Well, I call a question.
Okay, as many as are in favor of moving the bill out with individual recommendations, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm sorry, we did make the record, so I, all of us will raise those hands again, please. In favor, please, moving it out with individual recommendations, Mr. Greenberg, Mr. Sun, Mr. Clark, Mr. Miller. Opposed? Mr. Phillips, Mr. Pettigrew, Mr. Taylor. Okay, the bill moves with individual recommendations.
Mr. Chairman, can I try the letter of intent?
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Clark.
I have proposed, you may have seen an earlier draft of it. The effort in the letter of intent is to get a zero fiscal note, very simply stated. And I have written three changes to, I think, what you saw as an earlier draft. First of all, a technical change, section 12 is the reference. The elimination of the word non-emergency, because there is no such thing, as pointed out by Carla Forsyth. The furthermore sentence, which again clarifies that if the suggestion was that there'd be additional screening of these, and I urge the position of the committee be that if there is screening, it's simply a matter of delaying the petitions for a while rather than adding new bodies to make sure that there are no delays. Again, the point being of the letter of intent is that we need a zero fiscal note. They can implement it without additional cost.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman?
I object to the letter of intent. Maybe the maybe Representative Clarkson could tell me if we're not going to have to do any screening, who's going to make the decision on whether or not we have high or low child support, and whether or not it's unusual child custody provisions.
I'm not suggesting that there isn't going to be screening. It is possible that they'll be able to draft a form that will allow a clerk to screen it if an in-court assistant or whatever has to do the screening. All I'm suggesting is that you don't add a bunch of in-court clerks to do the screening. You screen them as a part of your regular function. And if it takes you a couple of extra days to get your petition scheduled because of delays in screening them, then that's what we're prepared to accept rather than the necessity of adding new bodies. You can do it one of two ways. You can either pass the bill and hire some new bodies and say that there's going to be a 14-day period between filing it and having a hearing, or you can say no new bodies and it's going to take 21 days from the time you file it to the time you hear it. I'm suggesting that the latter is preferable because it will be a zero fiscal.
I doubt if it'll seriously have any effect on this committee's vote. What I suggest to you, I'll withdraw the objection and move the question on the letter of intent.
I object. I want to speak.
Okay, Mr. Greenberg, go ahead.
I support the letter of intent, but I have problems with one sentence, and I would like to consider the relation to the sentence. And that is the second sentence in the second paragraph. The costs are further reduced because a judge reviewing these petitions may reject those which require a heightened level of judicial scrutiny, but do not on their face meet the standards in that subsection. I think that's just confusing. I don't think we need to say that to make our case. And I would request that we go to the
next. Mr. Chairman, if you recall the court system testimony, it was that these hearings could take up to 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And when we explored that question, the suggestion was that it would not take 2 hours. It would take 5 or 10 minutes to determine whether or not these are cases that required additional scrutiny, and if they did, then the judge could say, go back and rework your agreement, so they wouldn't spend 2 hours in front of the judge.
Mm-hmm.
sure that it not, it may not imply that there needs to be additional judges to fund this.
No, I don't have any problem in doing what you're saying, it's the sentence itself, I think is confusing. And let me make one of two suggestions. We can certainly pass the bill out and tomorrow take up the letter of intent, and I'll work with Representative Boxman on it. Otherwise, I would request that we do the, I think that that sentence is confusing, maybe it's late and I'm just confused, but I do think that sentence is confusing. I don't have any problem with the rest.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want the record to indicate that anybody's gonna ever see a judge out of this thing in Anchorage anyhow. We've had testimony both in Hess and here, people do not see judges on these things. We're talking about clerks reviewing a disillusion on a whole bunch of arbitrary standards that have now been shoved through here. What everybody wants, then we'll have a bunch of little clerks trying to figure out yes or no, up or down, whether it has to be reviewed. Then it's going to go in front of somebody who isn't a judge either, and that's a master. And no, nobody's going to hire any more judges. Nobody's going to actually ever sit in front of a judge on most of this stuff in our major metropolitan area that handles probably more cases than any place else. So let's don't be putting it on the record about worrying about hiring some new judges. We're going to get a pat on the head fiscal note out of somebody on this thing. And if it ends up dropping one dime from what it is right now, I'm going to scream a lot louder than I'm screaming right here, because that's phony.
Mr. Redwood,
you don't agree with the principle that you can simply delay the period of time and not increase the workload?
Not at all. You start delaying things in that system, you're going to jam that system up and you're going to have more people. You've had a system so jammed up across the street over here, they've had to fly two people in here to work for the last month just to try and get it open back up again. At tremendous cost.
Well, we're getting sidetracked a little bit. I don't care if we believe that sentence.
I'd ask unanimous consent.
The objection to Mr. Winberg's motion to delete the sentence. Is there objection then to the
Object.
So you can't go to
school.
What? We have to move the fiscal note.
Okay, I had indicated Mr. Thompson, because I thought we were going to start at 7 o'clock, but I did indicate him to leave first on 463. I understand that there's a many substitute for this bill as well. And that doesn't have to leave. Remember, do you want to walk us through the
yes, and this,
bill.
I
thought we gave the first half hour to Mr. Thompson. I think the first half hour is up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
He's got 3 minutes.
Move on to the other bill.
He's got 3 minutes.
Yeah, he's got 3 minutes.
Come on.
Would you like to join us at the table, Mr. Thompson, and have a conversation? Mr. Winberg will walk us through.
I guess just for the purposes of discussion, I should move this committee.
Okay, is there objection for the purposes of discussion to adopt the
May I make a request? I'm not at my desk. Honor, do you feel...
No, I
haven't seen CS. Okay, but on the CS, I will deal with that then, Mr. Chairman. What the bill does, if we take it section by section, first, in section one, language has been added in on lines, and I just asked the members of the committee to look at the original bill and section one of the committee's article. On lines 21 through 24, we have added that you can civilly compromise a case involving assault by one spouse against the other if the court finds that a divorce is pending between the spouses and a restraining order against further assaultive behavior has been issued. This will allow the court some leeway in a situation where there are already protections against further assaultive behavior and where, in fact, a situation as follows may arise. There may be a situation where one spouse has hit another spouse. The spouses then have separated and both have attorneys and are in the process of getting a divorce. And one of the holdups in the divorce may be
that there is a pending assault charge by the state or the municipality against one of the spouses. And that spouse, we'll call that spouse the defendant's spouse, refuses to go through with the divorce and end this thing, which everybody believes should be ended, simply because this assault charge is pending. And everybody would like, both the spouses and their attorneys and the court, if it had the leeway, to simply dismiss the thing. And this, in fact, does happen, not very often, but it does happen. And this will not require the court to grant the civil compromise, but simply give the court jurisdiction to do so. The language appears on page 1, lines 21 through 24, the unless clause. And that's the change. And I realize I'm arguing a little bit for this as we go through, but that'll save a little bit of time. Section 2 of the legislation is amended by adding the sentence on page 2, lines 9 through 12. And what the present law says is the final language that's in capital letters. And the present language requires in sentencing, when the court determines whether or not to order restitution, it must take into account the financial resources of the defendant and the nature of the burden the payments will impose. And a number of cases have been reversed because the court didn't do this. The bill would have just simply eliminated that. And I personally felt that was unfair. And that the court should look at that, but that the burden, and this is in accord with the third section, and it's in accord with a case called Johansson versus the state, the same kind of policy, that the if there's an order of restitution to be entered, and the defendant feels that he can't pay it, can't afford to pay the restitution, that the burdens on that defendant to establish by a preponderance of the evidence his or her inability to pay restitution. And this simply really tracks this third section and brings these two sections into conformance and establishes a fair procedure. The third section here is the same as the original section 3 of the bill. And that's basically it. If I omitted anything.
Mr. Sun?
Chairman, just a clarification. Page 2 of lines 6 through 8 just reference the public or private nonprofit. That takes in police departments, hospitals, shelters, psychiatrists, mental health institutions. Anybody who has seen or touched these people on the way.
Can you answer me? I don't know that police would have provided counseling, medical, or shelter services, but certainly that would anybody who did would could be included in there. And there, by the way, I'm sorry, there was one other thing I forgot. And if you look here on page 2, line 3, we have eliminated the word larcenously, and larcenously previously appeared in the original bill and in present law on line 18. And that's a different issue, and I need to bring that to your attention. What the present law says is if the crime was committed larcenously, in other words, with a theft, as in the element, you can't civilly compromise. And this, I think, is unnecessarily restrictive because you may have a shoplifting charge, and it may involve maybe somebody who conceivably is very young or senile and going through emotional stress or something, and it really is the kind of thing that they should be able to civilly compromise. And the court should, in appropriate cases, and again, this just gives the court jurisdiction to do it, should have the authority to do it, and so we have a limit on that. And I forgot to mention that.
You're in concurrence with this version of the
I wouldn't go that far, no. This is not my committee substitute, Mr. Chairman. Representative Grunberg has had this prepared.
Okay, we have
what's wrong with it.
I'm a little confused.
It appears that Mr. Thompson has taken the point of view that anything this committee wants to let his bill go is acceptable.
Does it have another committee?
I claim, you know, if there's a problem with it, you have a problem with it.
Maybe misunderstanding.
No, this has been prepared as a committee substitute. This is not a sponsor substitute. I'm familiar with the draft here.
Why am I waiting for the other?
You're on, Thompson.
What is your view of what you would like to see?
I would like to see this bill moved from this committee.
What kind of language would you like to see adopted by the House of Representatives?
Relative to that last concern, Mr. Chairman, I think that perhaps larcenously should be in a separate subsection. I don't know that it's appropriate to break it out like that in this subsection, but that's something that's been done by the drafter of this committee substitute.
We have a memo in your files to Mr. Thompson's office from Patrick Connelly, where he says the technical manner in which the larcenously language is repealed is that we're drafting the new prohibition against compromise and domestic assault should be added to a new subsection 5. This would ensure that there would not be any confusion between the new language and that which now appears in cross-references in existing statutes and important statutes referring to AF 1245.174.
That's technical. I certainly have no problem with that, Mr. Chairman. This was prepared. I see we have Mr. Bradley here, who's just wishing I hadn't called on him. But may I ask, how should this be done, Dave?
This isn't my bill.
Mr. Court, is the drafter on this.
May I make a suggestion? If we do take action, and I hope we do, maybe we could just run that, the Conheady suggestion, by Mr. Ford in whichever way the council could take care of that.
Do I understand right that we're only talking about the technicality of where it should be placed? Mr. Conheady has no objection to the language or the lack thereof. He's referring to just where it
I wouldn't speak for anyone in this room.
Okay. Mr. Conheady is present. Do you see this as simply a technical matter, Mr. Conheady? I'll just be a little informal unless you reply back.
No, Mr. Chairman. I see it. Number one is a technical matter, and number two is something I object to on a policy vote. To illustrate Mr. Grunberg's recent example, if a person who was picked up for shoplifting is the type that deserves to have it civilly compromised out, pray if we still have a diversion program next year, that's the type of disposition that would happen. What we might end up seeing is the other side of the coin, where a person has a shoplifting charge who may have two or three major felonies, maybe on probation, where it behooves him to go and to really buy off, we'll say a merchant, to get out from under having his probation or the shoplifting.
I'm sorry, if you finished, may I respond to that?
Yeah, go ahead, Mr. Chairman.
That gets to the heart of the civil compromise statute. And this is a unique statute in the law. And it allows the judge to dismiss certain cases based on the fact that there's a civil settlement. And if, in fact, that argument's true with respect to larcenous crimes, it's true with respect to any type of crime. And if you like that argument, then maybe we shouldn't allow civil compromises generally. You could say a person has a crime that involves another kind of assault, not a spousal, a domestic assault. And they could have had other kinds of assaultive behavior in the past, assaults with dangerous weapons, et cetera. This could have been an attempt to buy off the victim. I don't think that gets to the difference between larcenous crimes and other crimes. And, you know, if you buy that particular argument, the answer to that is pretrial diversion in all of these cases, and that argues against the whole statute. My own view is the exact opposite, that it simply gives the judge the authority to do this. It doesn't require the judge to do that, and why should we eliminate one option that may be a very good option in a given case, and that kind of an argument that Mr. Connolly raised is an argument that the prosecutor could raise against a civil compromise argument. Yes. I don't want to push you. Oh, do I?
I'll
do
that.
Okay, go ahead.
This is Phil.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass out the committee substitute for House Bill 462 Judiciary as a committee with individual rights.
Just the 311.
The 311 version.
May I just make a request? I agree with the one technical thing that the staff can work on the placement of that word larceny.
I agree.
The motion is to move the bill out with individual recommendation. Quite frankly, as the chair, I'm just moving it out. And as a member of the group, I should say, I'm a little nervous about moving out a bill that I haven't even got an indication from the sponsor. That's a bill that he wants to support, although.
Mr. Chairman, it's his bill.
He wants to.
He wants to put it out.
He wants it out. Best to leave it alone.
I strongly suspect it's what, well, never mind. We're not reading.
I'll object if that makes you feel better.
Well, first you're happy to make an objection myself. I don't know if yourself, anybody else. I'm just a little hesitant that if it's the will of the committee, it's fine. Well, Mr. Sutton?
I'd like to get on the next. I don't like the idea of public or private nonprofit organizations. The concept of anybody who this person or persons ever goes to walks into court and hands in an invoice and a bill for services rendered, psychiatric on down. I had a little problem almost with Representative Taylor on void for vagueness in the last bill, but this one is totally void for vagueness. But that's something somebody else has battled down the road. They don't have my support necessarily on that section.
Mr. Page,
I move that we delete sections 2 and 3 of the bill.
Okay.
In light of what the representative from Ketchikan said, I mean, I used to practice in this area somewhat, and the fact is that when let's talk about reality instead of using euphemism, you have a wife who goes to an awake shelter, and the husband, from his perception, feels that the people at the awake shelter have convinced his wife that they should get divorced. They've convinced his wife that she should file charges, and it gets pretty hairy. And if you're going to take the same guy who may not, most of these people don't have a lot of money, and say, well, we're going to bill you for it, sucker. It's insult on injury, and I think you're just stirring up trouble in the real world out there that you really don't want to do.
Sure. I object to the motion. And I understand the spirit in which it's made. I think it's very important when you're dealing with the concept of restitution to allow, in an appropriate case, the court to order restitution in this manner, because these may be very real costs that the victim has to incur. And certainly if you hear me before you shut
up. I didn't say anything.
I can see the ears. If in fact this particular counselor or center or whatever it is encouraging further disharmony, I would think that is the kind, and this would be a sufficiently unusual order, that it would be the kind of request that the victim would make. And the court would be able to investigate the quality and the kinds of services that were granted there. And that's the intent of this. It says may. If you look over here on page 2, line 5, the court may order restitution of various types. Frankly, there's nothing that
is that unusual about this? And it simply makes it clear, and it gives the court a particular option they may not have thought of before. And I think it's very important, and I think it'll mean a great deal to a number of victims in very worthwhile organizations. And if it's abused in a given case, the court just wouldn't order it. At least that would be my presumption. They're smart judges.
Mr. Chairman, sections 2 and 3 are a funding bill for your agencies. That's all they are. And if anybody thinks that we're talking about something different, you're wrong. It's to provide restitutionary funding for the various shelters and groups. They're the ones that are going to be submitting the bills. And the counseling that Representative Pettijohn was talking about is exactly accurate in a lot more cases than it is not. The advice is always, you've been slapped around and beat up, maybe you need a divorce. Now here's what we're going to do to help you get it. And if you don't comply with our advice, then you're not going to be welcome back here next time around. That's why we've got this silly thing in front of us to begin with. Now we're going to fund them.
Mr. Chairman, I don't necessarily speak against the restitution concept. I think a person causes the damage or causes the cost. I don't have any problem with having to pay. My problem goes to the fact I don't know what shelter services are. And I just bring up the vagueness of the actual items, the counseling, medical. I think I know what medical costs are sometimes. But the counseling and shelter services, I don't know what those words mean. I know what room and board means. I'm not sure what shelter services means. I don't have a problem if the person incurs the legitimate cost of someplace. I'll go on a user pay theory on this bill. But I'd just like to have a little better definition of what those words stand for.
Mr. Chairman, counseling is well defined. Counseling is therapy or any kind of assistance in the sense of attempting the victim to talk and work through the problem. And I think that's well defined and well known to the people who practice in this area. Well, shelter services include such things as the Awake Shelter in Anchorage and the Aware Shelter in Juneau. And they're, when you're talking in terms of shelter service in this area, it is a term of art. And there are not that many, and they're well recognized and well known by the law enforcement agencies and the judiciary in the
field. There's a way that to deal with your problem, I think, if you had a cross-reference to the services provided by a program under the Council for Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. There are a number of definitions in there. I can't remember off the top of my head what that citation is, but we could simply put that cross-reference. It would incorporate those definitions. Maybe resolve some of your vagueness thing. While I have the floor to speak on the motion, I would support, I think if you look at section 2, I think you ought to leave in the restitution language on lines 6 through 8 with the revision I've just suggested, but I'm sort of convinced by Mr. Conhetti's letter that it would be a mistake to change the financial resources language in the way that is suggested here, because he cites an Alaska Court of Appeals case that does address that question and set a fairly specific standard. I hate to reverse a Court of Appeals decision by putting some new language in there. And I don't know where we are procedurally, whether I could amend.
I'll withdraw my motion, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, just procedurally.
Let's deal with the second one first, and we can discuss that easily. We know what.
On page 2, Mr. Chairman, I move that we delete the new language on lines 9 through 12 and reinsert the existing language, which is bracketed on 12 through 15. Well, and I cite Carr versus State, 686 P. 2nd, 1192.
Where are we? Don't you also want to delete section 3?
Can we
we wait?
Yeah.
I may, but I haven't thought that through yet. Okay?
Right.
Okay. Motion understood?
Yep.
Yeah. I would like, I'm slightly confused here. It seems to me that what we are doing here, we have, the present language in the law, in both in 1255.045A and 1255.051A, does not state who has the burden of showing inability to pay. And what this bill does is it puts the burden on the defendant. Mr. Connedy's nodding. I am stating that correctly. This shifts the burden where it ought to go. The court, and the way these things operate in the real world, there's a very brief little interchange, if anything. And the judge, right now, enters an order of restitution. There's nothing to compel that defendant to testify. And the judge can't possibly know whether the defendant has the ability to pay or not. The person who has the knowledge as to whether he has the ability to pay is the defendant. And this makes it very clear that the burden should be on that defendant. He's the only one that knows whether he can pay or not. And putting the burden on him is very appropriate in these cases, because he's the only one that knows whether he can pay, and that's all the bill does. I'm arguing against the amendment. I think the bill does.
I agree. This is Judge Taylor regularly complied with the requirements of the existing statute. So certainly possible.
But that doesn't mean that Judge Taylor or any other judge knew, and maybe Judge Taylor did in Rangel, because Judge Taylor probably knew everybody in Rangel. But that's not true about Judge Moody and Angel, or Ripley.
I mean, I have a ready for question. As many are as are in favor of the amendment, which would be to delete the new language now line 9 through 12 and reinserting the existing language beginning on line 12 through 15. As many are in favor of that motion, raise their hand. Mr. Pettijohn, Mr. Taylor, Mr. Fox, Mr. Simons, Mr. Miller. Mr. Phillips?
No.
Yes, okay. As many are opposed, raise their hand. Mr. Phillips, Mr. Goodman.
Mr. Chairman, now back to the first one. I think it works if after victim on line 8 you add the words as provided in AS 1866.010 through 900. It's the entire chapter, the definition for section 900. And I would move that amendment.
I don't object for discussion. I think that does lend some definition. My difficulty with it is what we're really talking about here is ordering people to pay some amount arbitrarily set by the shelter or its personnel for counseling services by unlicensed, uncertified people who happen to be employed and working in that program. And I think that's just totally inappropriate.
If I could just suggest that that might be an argument to delete the restitution entirely.
I mean, what you're in essence doing, you're not only validating whatever the definition may be of counsel within those settings through this proposition. But you're also going to have a court order that it be paid.
Let me tell you, by the way, if I could comment on your comments, I was aware of some shelters that did attempt to condition the provision of shelter services on the filing of criminal complaint or a divorce. I strongly objected to that a couple, 3 years ago, and it's my understanding that it's the policy of the council that doesn't happen anymore.
It's still the advice given.
I was going to say that I'm agreeing with you that that's real bad policy, and it isn't their formal policy.
They may not be holding the keys to the door anymore, but that's still exactly what's going on inside. And I mean, if I really believe there was a whole bunch of people in there that were going to work their heart out to put that marriage back together, that would be something different. But reality has never shown me that to occur in that setting. Instead, once they go through that door, there's an active and aggressive effort made to make certain that that marriage is destroyed. And this bill goes 100 miles right down the road, not only certifying that activity, but requiring that it be paid for, and furthermore, not allowing anyone to dismiss.
Like to say, I'm not sure it's quite as true in the shelter in my area.
Well, I hope yours is an exception, and I think through the years, all of them have improved a great deal in their credibility. But this bill is basically saying that that lady no longer has a right to choose. Once she has been placed in a certain position and has signed her name on the line, her rights of choice are now destroyed. I'm very much for it.
We're dealing with the bill then. That
we're also dealing right here with whether, I mean, if she spends the night in the shelter and has counseling services provided by an uncertified, unlicensed individual, that is, as Representative Pettijohn indicated, probably counseling advice that she should get out of that marital situation.
Well, that's just trying to take care of his vision.
Mr. Thomas, he wants to have a comment.
I mean, if you want to put in licensing and certification, that kind of stuff, then I think they know what we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have been trying mightily to refrain myself from responding to most of these proceedings, but I'm frankly fast losing it. I object strenuously to the characterizations made by Representative Taylor, and I frankly am astonished to hear them. Regardless of how you feel about these shelters, they are frankly all we have. Yes, they are unlicensed because this state does not provide adequate services in that regard. I have a great deal of admiration for these people who at least attempt to do something about these problems. I do not consider this a friendly amendment, nor did I consider the last one. I'm going to ask this committee to please recognize that I am the sponsor of this bill, and you are fast approaching the point beyond which I will feel comfortable with this legislation at all. Having said my piece, I will now try again mightily to refrain and ask you to please vote on this amendment and
proceed.
You don't
like this amendment? This would help.
Pardon?
You didn't like the last one either? I can understand that.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Phillips and Mr. Enberg.
No, if the sponsor wants the bill or as is, I think we ought to pass it up. You know, we can still vote no here. I mean, the body's going to make the decision, not us. Mm-hmm. And I have a strong feeling about the, you know, the author of the bill, to leave it the way, if he wants it the way, fine. Let's put it up on the floor, up or down.
We don't need committees.
Let's just go right from introduction to rules.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to do something I can't recall ever having done before. Mm-hmm. But what Mr. Thompson said impels me to do it. And I feel really strongly about what we did this last amendment. Because what we've got now is a bill that's inconsistent within itself. We have Section 3. And Section 3...
I was going to do that.
You were going to delete Section 3?
I was trying to break it up so we could get...
We're trying to get a definition right now for what this is supposed to be
Well,
for.
Okay, well, I'll get to that.
Yeah, we have a motion on the floor.
I will want to be heard on that.
Okay, so we have a motion right now to add definition to the bill. Is there objection to the definition?
Yes, I still maintain the
definition. Mr. Taylor objects to the definition suggested by the bill. Are you ready for the question? All in favor of the motion to adopt the definition proposed by Mr. Clarkson, raise your hand, please. Mr. Clarkson, Mr. Miller. All opposed to the definition?
I'm the
AA. Okay, Mr. Sanders is the AA. Opposed are Mr. Grunberg, Mr. Phelps, Mr. Pettijohn, Mr. Taylor. Okay, the amendment fails. Mr. Grunberg, you want to be heard?
I think you're going to move to delete Section 3.
Well, I gather that's what's necessary to for there to be consistency. I'll move it to delete Section 3.
I'll object.
Yeah.
I would like Mr. Con... Before we vote on this, I'd like Mr. Con Eddy to come to the table.
We have testimony over everything.
We're never
going to
get
this right. We don't need any more of this.
We told Cotton we'd have... Yeah, we're up an hour already.
I think we need to get it out.
Okay, well, I...
We'd like to take that motion about 15, 20 minutes ago, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman.
Question.
No big deal.
The motion is before us. You're correct, Mr. Phillips. You placed a motion to advance the bill
one of the committee substitutes.
The PSC has a motion.
Motion to delete section three.
Oh, the meeting, so that motion's...
Yeah, you got that.
All right. I beg your pardon.
Question.
Question.
Okay, so all in favor of the motion? Raise your hand. Raise your hands. Mr. Bettyjohn, Mr. Clarkson, Mr. Miller, Mr. Sims, Mr. Taylor, opposed. Mr. Grunberg, Mr. Stokes. All right, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Taylor?
In light of our inability to find a satisfactory definition of the type of services to be provided, I move that section two be deleted.
Question.
I object. Object.
Question.
All the members, as many as are in favor, raise their hand. Bettyjohn, Mr. Phillips. You, oh, okay, Mr. Phillips, Mr. Excuse me, Mr. Bettyjohn, Mr. Taylor. And the opposed motion, balance the committee.
Move the bill, Randy.
Come on.
Okay, so not the third time.
We think it's a move bill out. Committee substitute.
Mr. Phillips moves the bill. Committee substitute, raise your hand. Is there objection to that motion? Hearing no objection, the bill moves out.
Thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Hey, make them back again, Dave. Okay, two out of the way, now the tough one is here.
Okay.
You thought that was easy?
We'll now take up committee substitute for House Bill number 502, Finance.
He's trying to refrain himself.
An act relating to confidential tax information, Department of Revenue, providing for effective date. Original sponsor rules, including budget audit.
Welcome to our committee.
That was a hard act to follow.
Yeah.
I might mention, we have Mr. Bradley here from our drafting offices, and also representative from the Department of Law here. We get into some complicated legal issues we have.
I'd like to know, this is the first time in my memory when the Judiciary Committee has been dealing with a finance committee substitute.
That was your chance for revenge.
Don't worry, Sam, we got it all out of venom out of our system.
Yeah. Okay, Mr. Cotton, would you tell us about your bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to thank the Judiciary Committee for taking time out of their evening to have a meeting. The bill was referred to the Judiciary Committee by a motion I made on the House floor at the request of the Minority Leader, and I met with the Minority Caucus, and upon their request, allowed that it was a reasonable request, and appreciate the chairman giving me early scheduling. I'll give you a little history of how the bill came about, and to begin with, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee last summer met up in Palmer, and there was a request from the administration to move $1.5 million from the Department of Revenue to the Department of Law to assist with some disputed tax collections on a couple of different subjects. And as a result of that inquiry, we started learning more and more about what the back tax or disputed tax situation was. And as we attempted to discover more information about that, we learned a lot about the confidentiality statutes that are currently on the books. The Budget and Audit Committee subsequently voted to introduce this bill in both houses. And in its original state, it would have allowed the Department of Revenue's assessments to become public information. And that was not well received by those affected. And the Finance Committee elected to propose quite a different proposition. And that would include an ability of the legislature to review confidential information in executive session. The Finance Committee then wrestled with different mechanical means to get there from here. We originally suggested that a committee could request it if the presiding officer of either body approved that request. At the suggestion of Representative Binkley, we changed that to a requirement that the either legislative body pass a simple resolution in addition to a written request by the committee. And upon passage of that resolution, the department would be asked, would be required to turn over whatever specific information was requested by the committee. The bill, at the suggestion of the Department of Law, who gave us a lot of help on this, and the Department of Revenue, who has also been very helpful, begins with a findings and purpose section that is pretty self-explanatory. Starting on page 2, at the bottom of the page there, section 2, this will just take a minute to give you a quick sectional analysis. This Title 24 deals with legislative ethics title that would make it a violation of the Legislative Ethics Code to disclose information. Section 3 was added at the suggestion of the Department of Revenue because apparently our ethics code now only applies to legislative assistance over the range of 18, I believe. So this would add any other legislative employees to that provision.
Wait.
Section, pardon me?
That's Section 3 of the Finance Committee substitute.
Yeah.
Do you want questions now? Or do you want to hold?
Yeah, let's go ahead and have them now. It doesn't represent too much anyway.
Yeah,
2460
fine.
Is the ethics code?
Well, let's see here. I don't have the statutes with me right here. So.
Well, that's Section
20, 3. Is it 2460 or is it 2410? Title 24 deals with that.
60.
Okay, so 2410 is the. Like I said, I don't have the statutes here. One of them was intended to cover legislators and staff, and at the, again, at the request of the Department of Revenue, the additional section would have included any other legislative employees that weren't originally covered.
I understand that, but I'm not. My memory is that the phrase, a person to whom this chapter applies, on line 3, means only those range.
So that must be
whatever
the
it is or above.
Section 3 must be the legislators and those staff that are covered, and Section 2 must be the others. Is that correct? Yeah. I'm
two.
Being not the Commissioner of Revenue.
Yeah. Section 2 would be.
My,
all,
I've
would
had
be all
those mixed
that. Right.
Section 4 deals with the
okay.
proceedings of the committee that would, again, the purpose of that would be to continue to give the taxpayer protection in a proceeding before the Ethics Committee. Section 5, nothing really changes there other than we say that it would be a felony because but it was suggested we put that in there. But as you know, anything that allows a prison term of more than 1 year is not a misdemeanor but in fact a felony. So that's clearly defined.
Mr. Chairman, what does section, what is 4305-230? You know what that
I don't have the statute right now with me. That is the confidentiality section in the revenue statutes. Title 43 is revenue.
Thank you.
Then Section 6 goes on to describe mechanically how the legislature would go about obtaining that information. And as I mentioned earlier, the committee would make a request in writing, and the body would have to pass a simple resolution granting that authority. Beginning on line 18, deal with the extra protection that would be, again, the purpose of this would be to give that extra protection to the taxpayer as far as the his right to privacy and an attempt to maintain the confidential nature of that information. After the resolution would have passed, the committee would hold an executive session. Those members of the legislature wishing to attend that executive session would have to acknowledge in writing that they understood the information was confidential, that its disclosure was illegal, and that they would be waiving their constitutional immunity granted by Article 2, Section 6. Sections J and K on page 5, pretty self-explanatory. The committee and the commissioner would establish procedures for transmitting and safekeeping of the confidential information. And subsection K, again, is a recommendation from the Department of Revenue that would satisfy the Internal Revenue Service's desires to maintain their information. And in other words, the legislature wouldn't see the federal tax returns is essentially what that does. The question of immunity waiver is one that has caused a lot of eyebrows to move around, and there's a couple of the opinion from the Attorney General suggests that the United States Congress, of course, enjoys this privilege now. And although I don't have the federal statutes with me, she suggests that there is precedent and that, in fact, the United States Congress has waived at least some certain immunities. The state of California has a statute, I think you've got it in your packet here, that, that makes such a disclosure a misdemeanor. And I'm going to quote from the Attorney General's opinion here. I don't know if you've got that. It's dated February 21st. It's addressed to Lou Ann Cutler, House Finance Committee, from Harold Brown, Attorney General. At the bottom of page 2, in naming a precedent, Helstosky, the court suggested but did not decide that Congress could enlist the aid of the executive branch and the courts in disciplining its members by a narrowly drawn statute. In other words, the Congress could pass a law saying that the executive branch and the court system could step in and help enforce discipline on its members. She continues, although the issue apparently has never arisen, and that is one of the problems here, that there hasn't been a real test of this question. Internal Revenue Service takes the position that Congress has done just that in Section 6103, so that members of Congress are not immune from penalties for disclosure. We also have an opinion from Mr. Bradley, who's here today, and I won't pretend to speak for him, but he discusses the right to privacy versus legislative immunity, and I don't believe concludes that that we do or do not have the ability to waive that. Again, I won't pretend to speak for him. Of course, the purpose of doing that is to protect the confidential nature of the information and to protect the right of privacy of the taxpayer. If I were to attend the executive session and sign the acknowledgement and then proceed to carry a tax return to the floor of the House and read that, then at that point, I'm certain that the case would find its way to the state Supreme Court and we would get an answer to the question. I don't believe that answer is available to us today, although I think I would be reluctant to take that chance. And so that there again, that's one of the reasons why we've suggested that that we can waive immunity and that we would be eligible for a felony penalty. And of course, the backstop is that the legislature can discipline its own members, and by making this a violation of the ethics code, well, that would be a backstop, if you will. I'd be glad to answer questions, and I know that the Commissioner of Revenue is here to either testify or answer questions. I know they're in support of the bill. They testified in finance in favor of the legislation. Department of Law has been helpful in helping us draft the legislation, and Mr. Bradley's here as well. He's the drafter.
Thank you. Before we proceed further, I wanted to make one observation for the record, and that the representative from Exxon, I was in my office today, left this position paper on the part of his company, indicated that he did not wish to testify tonight, but he wished for this to be made available to the committee, and I told him that this would be made as part of the official record of the hearing, and I'm showing him in right now. Having said that, could I get some indication of people who are here that would like to testify, just so I can kind of schedule time?
So Ohio also testified in Finance Committee in opposition to the legislation.
I didn't see any hands raised. Larry, did you talk?
Not necessarily.
Okay. Members of the committee, do you have questions? Mr. Grunberg?
Right now we have a set of statutes that allow the committee to subpoena records. Why not just use that?
It's my understanding that the interpretation from the Department of Revenue, they wouldn't agree that you have that power.
I'd like to hear from the Department of Revenue on that issue, then, Mr. Chairman.
There's a specific statute that prohibits you from seeing the information, so I think that's good to tell you whatever.
Yeah, we'll give the opportunity to the Commissioner in just a minute. Let's hold that one in advance for a minute.
Okay. But my follow-up question would be, if there is a specific statute that prohibits that information, why not just add a clause that would say except if subpoena? And that would make the two statutes congruently used by subpoena rather than by resolution. I'll ask them.
Yeah.
Well, I'd respond again by saying that the constitutional right to privacy and our immunity, I think, requires a certain balance there. And so by just allowing us to subpoena information, you would have to go into the confidential nature of that and discuss what protections might be available to the taxpayer. So I don't think it would be quite as simple as just adding another line there. But I would prefer to do this as simply as possible, so if you've got that idea, that's good.
What I'm suggesting would be this, it's just a simple question without having studied the situation, but if we already have a subpoena method of doing this, and if I have a second method of having to go to a whole resolution, we can build in any protections you want under a subpoena method, and that's already on the books.
I'll defer and yield to the Department of Law and Revenue on that question.
Hey, Mr. Senator, and Mr. Foster.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Sam, I guess I would just ask the question. I mean, ultimately, the only time this comes up is when it's disclosed. You know, I mean, something happens here. What do you envision the penalties or what's going to happen if somebody walks on the floor of the House and reads off a tax return or whatever the confidential information is? What do you see as the steps that happen?
After that?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that the person whose tax return was read would probably file a complaint.
Okay, would it take some action from the taxpayer themselves to initiate a...
I don't know the answer to that question.
Or just the mere fact of doing it would trigger some discipline from our own members?
I think that, yes, in that case, I think you would find it, because our ethics code then would be very, very specific that it would be against the law to do that.
What do we see? The removal from office?
Well, that's
10
all.
10 days in jail, payment of fines. I'm just trying to get a concept here and also what the triggering device. Would the taxpayer have to show actual harm, or just the mere fact that there was disclosure of the of something that at one time was confidential? I don't want to confuse the issue. It's just a bunch of questions that are kind of running through my mind here. Maybe after we should let testify first.
But it'd be pretty straightforward, just like a violation of any law. I mean, what normally happens under those circumstances.
DA comes over.
It'd be a court case, and then
also
evidence would be reviewed. And I don't know, maybe I'm missing the
well, you're actually, I'm just trying to get down what you're after, is that you want access to the information under certain conditions, but the penalty is mere disclosure, not the fact that the disclosure caused any harm. The act of violation is just disclosing it. That's what the wrong is.
Yes.
Is that what it is currently, Bob? I mean, just any of you guys that...
Yeah, there's a lot of the prosecution of that section, but the crime is willful disclosure, in particular the tax return, whether a question of harm to the taxpayer doesn't enter.
Clarkson had a question, then we'll...
It's relatively minor, but throughout a committee of acting, you may know that the practice in this body is often for a chair of a committee not to consult with a committee before taking a committee action. Would you object to specifying somewhere that, in fact, votes of the majority of the committee are required for each of these actions?
I don't think it's necessary. Not if you've got the body having to, you know, you'd have to have a majority of the House or the Senate approve the committee request.
Page 412.
But after that resolution, for example, it says that the committee may designate employees or agents to inspect the information.
Right.
I guess I can be concerned about a chair of a committee. Even one in the majority, I have to think ahead. The chair of a committee taking unilateral action to do this and not maybe having the support of the majority of the committee.
Well, there again, you'd have to have the support of the majority of the body, so I don't think that I don't think it would be a problem, but maybe I'm not thinking of some of the circumstances you're thinking about.
If I can just kind of comment on that, too. At least according to the law, not that it's not sometimes
at least inadvertently overlooked, at least according to the, actually the statutes, for a committee to introduce a bill, it should go before a committee. And usually that's not all that formal, but it's supposed to happen, so if it seems like something is relatively trivial as introducing a bill could be done, you know, and requires a committee vote, maybe something as serious as this ought to require a committee vote before they do it.
Well,
I don't, that's just a thought, I'm not.
I don't know, I just think that, you know, if the legislature putting, you know, you can put as many hoops as you want in front of you to get to accomplish your goal, I just think that would be an unnecessary additional hoop, since the will of the body is going to be called upon, you know, the majority of the body is going to have to approve the action, so I just think it's unnecessary personally.
Further questions before we talk to you? Mr. Taylor.
Basically, this, we don't have state income taxes now.
Yeah, we have corporate income taxes.
I know, but for individuals.
Individual income taxes.
But it's very likely that we're probably going to have to get into that in the not too distant future if well revenues go down. Does this mean that I can, if I'm sitting on the right committee, I can look up what everybody in town is doing for their taxes?
The body voted that way, but you as an individual legislator could not make that individual decision.
Take it with the House.
I think if I was chairman of that committee, we'd probably find it out.
Well, if you're a member of the legislature, of course, you can't be denied access to any executive session of a legislative hearing. So regardless of whether you're on that committee, you could attend the meeting if you're a legislator. But in order for that committee to receive that information, again, I think that a frivolous or capricious request like that might be limited by the requirement that 21 votes and a public, you have to go in front of the public to ask to receive the information.
I didn't read it, but I thought it was broader.
No.
21 people in that House got a vote before that information was disclosed to the committee?
Yes. Yeah. You check out the
page 4, line 2.
The bottom of page 3, a legislative committee, comma, after identifying the scope of an investigation or inquiry relating to matters of taxation and the adoption by either House of a simple resolution giving the committee authority to receive confidential information. Then the request by the committee shall be in writing and may identify directly or indirectly a particular taxpayer.
Mr. Foxman.
A memorandum from Luann Cutler to yourself of dated January 30th proposes amendments to limit the bill to the taxation of oil and gas production and pipeline activity instead of taxation of all corporate activity, et cetera, et cetera. That doesn't appear to have been incorporated.
No.
Could you tell us why that was?
Just. Of course, the idea was not to go after the small, the information that we wanted had to do with the major taxpayers.
That's why I would think that the amendment would have been adopted. Curious why it wasn't.
I don't remember why not. It may have been
I haven't read the finance notes. Was it offered formally?
No, it was not offered. It was not even discussed in the committee.
What is your I gather your position is that you want to focus on the ones that are identified in that memo.
Most likely, yeah. If you just pick out one industry, I think that they may feel a little picked on for one thing, and you may not have a good enough reason to make it that narrow. I'm not sure that there's any other, you know, if anybody else has anything to add on that. But
I'll be asking the same question because I'm inclined to narrow it if we're not barred from doing so.
Someday there may be other taxpayers who have make up a larger burden than they do now, and the ones we're thinking about might not be as great. That's probably not very likely, though. I don't know. I didn't think it was necessary.
I guess I'm a little confused. This is information that the State Department of Revenue presently has.
Yes.
Or would have.
They do have, yes, tax returns.
And they report to us and tell us things based on that information.
Some
things. They don't actually give us the information itself.
Well, they can tell you some things, but not others. Like, we were able to find out, as an example, that there was a, and currently is, an excess of $500 million in disputed income taxes. And there is an excess of $500 million in disputed severance taxes right now.
Yeah.
And we can't, but under current law, we can't learn much more than that. We can't find that out the nature of those disputes, what the assessments were, what the items of dispute are. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to pass this legislation. There may be an impossible tax law, or we may conclude that that compliance with current law is so terrible that we might need to make some adjustments to that law. Or perhaps the Department of Revenue is unable with current staff, or the people they have aboard may not be capable of carrying out timely enforcement due to restrictions, basically personnel or whatever.
Well, I guess it just seemed that that's information the executive presently has, and that they've gathered that because of the law we passed with tax. Is the purpose then to find out whether or not the executive's doing the job?
Well, I'm not suggesting they aren't doing the job now. There could be situations where the executive branch might not be doing the job that other people think they should be doing. Case of settlements, for instance, if you were the governor and there was a large amount of dollars in dispute, and you decided to settle for 10 cents on the dollar, we wouldn't know that. We wouldn't know that that's what the deal that you'd cut. And you would currently, as governor, have the ability to do that. And part of the legislative oversight function might be to help guard against situations.
I guess I don't understand why we wouldn't.
You can't know that now, because if you were to ask him, for instance, when ARCO Alaska came to the state January 13th, and it was announced that they had settled this case for $243 million, we asked, out of how much? What was the assessment? Well, we can't tell you; it's confidential. So everybody said, "Hey, it was a good one," and trust me. And most the people I talked to, I was confident that it had been a good settlement, but I didn't get to know the numbers. Neither did you. Theoretically, it could have been $1 billion and we settled for $243 million. Or it could have been $245 million and we settled for $243 million. But, and obviously that wasn't the kind of range that was probably there, but we don't know.
May end up with some real problems. I can understand where we might want to know what the gross amount was, but once we identify it to an individual taxpayer and it's in a disputed or litigated posture.
Not litigated. See, once it goes to court, then it becomes public.
Okay, but at least disputed.
Disputed, and those disputes carry on for many years. In fact, some of them go back as far as 1970 right now. Those disputed. Now, they may have been resolved, I don't know, but at one point, this year, there were some disputes as old as 1970.
Well, the temporary legal opinion of the northeast corner of the table here is that you can get at this through the subpoena power, but I would like to also hear from everybody else and testify before we get into the questions.
Okay, let's, Mr. Cohen, why don't you stay at the table with us, and let's ask Commissioner Norton.
Probably we ought to have somebody from the Department of Law address. Well, okay, because there are legal questions involved.
Hey, everybody come out.
Just add a couple more lawyers.
Yeah.
If you identify yourselves for
that. Yes, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, my name is Mary Nordy Allen, Commissioner of Revenue.
My name is Robert Jr. from the Department of Law.
Well, I guess my first question is,
I think Sam's already put it on the record, but I'd like to have you on the record. You, the administration and the department supports the legislation.
Yes, we do. We participated with the Department of Law in the drafting of this. It's closely patterned after the system that is used in other states, probably our prime source for the patterning was the federal law, which establishes the relationship between Congress and the executive dealing with tax matters. The problem of the, and I'm just giving you from a practical standpoint, there are two problems that seem to me to have been discussed. One was, why isn't the information that would be requested narrowed to a very limited number of taxpayers? And our feeling on that one is a problem of equal protection. The other is in response to the suggestion that the subpoena power of the legislature can be used to secure this information. The problem that we have is that existing law imposes a penalty of felony upon anyone in the Department of Revenue disclosing that information, so you get into an immediate conflict between the power of the legislature to subpoena information and the inability of anyone in the department to supply the information. At the same time, you get involved in that process with the privacy protections that this particular proposal seeks to retain.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Member,
with respect to the conflict with the felony provision, which is referred to here in section 5 on the bottom of page 3, I think that's simply cured, Commissioner, by simply making an exception if it's a subpoena. It's a felony unless the information is issued subject to a pursuant to a legislative subpoena.
Mr. Chairman. This is a penalty section, but the requirement to retain confidentiality appears in another section.
We could make that.
The difficulty is in that in tax administration and indeed legislative oversight, the potential for violation of confidentiality is so great in the subpoena situation that you're suggesting, that we have some very real concerns. It could really seriously impair the ability of the Department of Revenue to administer the tax laws and the legislature, for that matter, to participate in the drafting and assessment of the workings of the tax law.
We have bigger leaks in the department.
Yeah, Ms. Clark.
I have a series of questions.
I'd like to follow up.
Okay, I'll let the Schroeder follow up.
Commissioner, if you're concerned about leaks pursuant to a subpoena, the information would be going to the commission, the committee, the standing committee, whether it's pursuant to a subpoena approved by a majority of the committee members and signed by the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate on the one hand, or going to the committee pursuant to a resolution of the House. Simply the mechanism under which the information is released. The information is released to the committee in either case, and whether it goes by resolution or goes by subpoena, what is the difference as far as a leak? It's still going to the committee.
Okay.